Welcome back to The Signature of Man, a podcast dedicated to pursuing truth in the philosophy of art and beauty. This is episode 10 of The Signature of Man podcast, and I'm your host, Miguel Benitez Jr. In this episode, I had the opportunity to interview Dr. Jessica Meekum. Dr. Meekum is an adjunct professor at BYU Idaho, teaching classes for the music, art, and humanities departments. She recently finished her PhD in humanities from Faulkner University in Montgomery, Alabama, by defending her dissertation entitled The Eternal World Made Flesh, Spiritual and Religious Implications in Abstract Art. She has a master's degree from Northwestern University in Music History and Literature and a Master's of Library and Information Sciences from Brigham Young University. In addition to teaching at BYUI starting in 2002, she has also taught at College of Southern Idaho and Salt Lake Community College. She has four children, ages 18 to 29, and has been married to Bryce Meekum for 31 years. In her spare time, she enjoys traveling, hiking, cooking, and reading. In this episode, Jessica and I discuss abstraction and religion in art. Jessica also makes a case for greater acceptance of abstract art in Christian communities. So Jessica, thank you for joining me on the podcast today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
I'm totally happy to be here.
All right, great. So I was fortunate enough to have you in some of my classes in the Faulkner program. And so I knew that your interests and your studies would align with the interests and studies that go on for the podcast. And so I was looking forward to having you on. You've recently completed your work and your dissertation. And so congratulations on finishing that. And can you tell our audience a little bit about your topic for your dissertation?
Yeah, sure. I really wanted to approach the question of abstraction in art and how it related to religion and spirituality. In a way, in my mind, I felt like I was writing an apology for abstraction, if you will, largely in response to some of the long-held views of religious groups that somehow abstraction is a little bit of a scary way to communicate in art sometimes. And there are some biases, especially towards the modern art world and abstraction generally. And for me, that hadn't really been true. I have always enjoyed abstract art. I didn't exactly know why. And I wanted to be able to basically formulate a good argument with philosophy, starting with ancient philosophy, biblical support, all of those things to justify the use of abstraction in art and why we do it and why it's important. And also how it can be a great medium through which Christians today, if they were to take the time and effort, could really connect with art in a new and deeper way. And so that was basically my goal. And the dissertation pretty much follows the format of, you know, the first chapter being almost a literature review where you have the basic history and your definitions and all those kinds of things. And then I kind of do a syntopical study where I look at abstraction from different kinds of viewpoints, including the ancients and transcendence, including metaphor with Protestantism, including phenomenology, which has more of a Catholic embodiment in a lot of ways. And then the last chapter is basically a further argument to Christians specifically on the benefits of engaging with art generally, but abstract art as well, so that we can become better supporters of art and artists in our own congregations and in our world.
Excellent. Excellent. I'm hoping we can unpack some of that and here. So I'm very much looking forward to it. So you used the word abstraction. It's a major part of your thesis in your dissertation. I know the term sometimes gets used in different ways or gets used loosely, at least for the purposes of your research. How should we understand the idea of abstraction in art or when art uses abstraction? What does that mean?
I think that's a great question. And I think it's a really important question. And I did have to spend quite a bit, at least in the beginning parts of my chapters, to explain, to kind of come to a consensus of how I'm going to use this word, because the word, like you say, is really complicated. And it's used in a lot of different ways in a lot of different contexts, depending on what viewpoint you're going with. So it is kind of an interesting thing. So abstraction in art can take many forms and many guises. So we can say that something something is abstracted. And that means that you can still identify the object that is being depicted. You could identify that that is a human form, but it won't look like an actual human, or it won't look like the actual object. And a lot of art is abstracted, but it's still identifiable easily as a subject. In a lot of ways, we can
would that be, you know, many people are familiar with this, but like Picasso's use of various shapes, you know that there's a person there somewhere, right, in some sense, but
yes,
it doesn't look like a person.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Picasso's a good example, but even you could go back to, you know, the human figures that were discovered on the Cycladic Islands.
Yeah.
You know, those are really abstracted as well. So it has been a medium that's been our way to communicate. I guess you could say that's been a way around for a long time. Now, as far as it, some things being abstracted, I think it's probably important to back up just a little bit and make an argument that all art, to a certain extent, is an abstraction, because we're translating something that we're seeing onto a canvas or into a sculpture. And it's not as if someone stands in front of an art piece and thinks they're literally looking at a bowl of fruit. They're looking at a drawing of or a painting of a bowl of fruit, and they know that. And even naturalistic depictions do require the viewer to complete it, the meaning, in some way. An example of that would be when you're looking at really strong, what you could say, like classical naturalism or realism, right, where we have linear point perspective and everything, that really is a construct, if you will, because you're taking a two-dimensional surface and you're making it look like a three-dimensional surface. And I don't think you could probably say this nowadays, but back in the day, if people from other cultures viewed this construct of three-dimensionality on a two-dimensional surface, they were kind of confused. They didn't understand it. And so I think it is interesting to note that we're very, very used to that construct in the West, but it's not a worldwide standard by any means. So I think that's interesting to point out too, that all art is some level of abstraction. It just is dependent upon degree.
Okay.
And so when we talk about how things can be abstracted, that would be kind of a mild form of abstraction, but you could have patterned abstraction, like is really popular or used extensively in Islam, for instance. You could also have maybe pure abstraction. What we would call with pure abstraction would be you're looking at a canvas, for instance, and you can't say, oh, that's a house or that's a horse, or you can't say that it's depicting any object. It's reliant mostly on the elements of art, on line, on color, on gesture. Now, semi-abstraction, we could say, you know, a lot of abstract artists do that. They'll have a canvas that is really quite pure if you were just looking at it, you know, without any title. But once you add the title might give you a glimmer into what the artist meant. And so you can have kind of a semi-abstract piece as well. The one word that I tried not to use very much in my dissertation is non-objective. Sometimes, I mean, I think non-representational works better if you're trying to talk about pure abstract art rather than non-objective. And that's because a lot of artists who paint abstractly actually take issue with that term. They say you're trying to say that my art has no object or no point or no subject, and that is completely not true. And even the most, you know, the abstract expressionists, for instance, were very adamant that their art did have a subject. It did have a point. So non-objective was one that I did try and stay away from. And so those are the words that I used to describe abstraction in my dissertation. Now, as far as justifying abstraction artistically, and I don't know if you want to go there. I think there's some really interesting arguments as well. Probably the most interesting that I found was the work of Paul Crowther. He's an art critic and historian and commentator. And he talks especially about abstraction being justified as a very viable way to communicate in art because of the reality of what he calls transperceptual space. And transperceptual space is the kind of seeing that we do where we actually literally see things that are abstract in our day-to-day lives, or we see things with the mind's eye. So an example of transperceptual space would be what we see and comprehend in our peripheral vision, for instance.
Okay.
Or states of mind, or a dream state, or imagination, or emotions, or the macro and micro of the world and universe. All of these things are essentially abstract, but we don't talk about that kind of seeing very often. We talk more about the seeing we see straight ahead of us, the processing that we do that's more natural or easier to us. And so inherently, there's no question that when we're talking about pure abstraction, it is more complex. It's more complex because we're talking about things that we see that we don't usually pay attention to. And so I find that a very fascinating.
Yeah, that is very interesting. So I'm curious, you mentioned the, and then we can talk about how at least kind of two eras have used abstraction, but you mentioned that there's been some resistance to abstraction in art, particularly within Christian communities.
Yes.
Can you explain to us a little bit, what is the worry? What is the concern with abstraction in art?
Well, I think it is kind of twofold. And it's really interesting to see that starting in about the 50s and 60s, there were several really important authors that were evangelicals who were kind of basically doing apologies for art because they felt like a lot of specifically American Protestants had gotten away from really understanding what good art is. And so you have someone like Paul Tillich, who's a great philosopher and theologian who really loved abstract art. Expressionist art was his very favorite. He was known to have said Picasso's Guernica is the most spiritual and wonderful painting in human existence. It was his favorite. So, you know, we have people making an argument for art. Alfred Barr, who was, you know, curator of the Modern Museum of Art, was the son of a pastor and had a lot of thoughts about what art should and should not be. And he felt that we really could get away from some of the saccharine, typical, overly sentimental depictions that were seen in a lot of the art communities. And so I think that it's interesting to see. And then you've got like Francis Schaeffer, his Art in the Bible book, and some of those where they're basically making a case for art. And Schaeffer even says in his little book, he says, you know, there's not a godly style.
Right.
You know,
that's art in the Bible. Is what you're referring to.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Art in the Bible. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. However, when he gets to abstraction, he's not quite so generous with abstraction. Right. He says, but with abstraction, because it doesn't have any meaning, therefore it just doesn't have the impact and it loses. And he does not extend that generosity to abstraction. And you can kind of see this thread being picked up. You know, you've got Ruckmacher, who talked about, you know, modern art and culture, and he was very, in a lot of ways, suspicious towards a lot of modern art. And he assigned a lot of meaning to modern art that I think wasn't totally fair and was through the lens of being a contemporary of that art instead of having the benefit of looking back. And then Nancy Piercy and others who've kind of, you know, in their work, they've basically kind of denounced a lot of modern art, especially as being nihilistic, for instance. So like her argument that because there's no subject, it's ultimately nihilistic and God denying. But when you actually talk to the artists themselves, they don't say that and they don't think that. And so I thought that was interesting. But the thing was, is that the art world for so long was dominated by some critics and writers, Clement Greenberg being one, for instance, who routinely denied or would not acknowledge that a lot of the modern artists were coming towards their art with spiritual imperatives. In fact, I can't remember I think it was Jackson Pollock who said, he finally said, I just gave up talking to him about it because he wouldn't listen to me.
That's interesting.
And so there was like a narrative that was perpetuated that this stuff was nihilist, that it was damaging to culture and all sorts of things like that. And so in the last 10 or 15 years, there's just been this great resurgence of a lot of more contemporary Catholic theologians / art critics and art lovers, I think, who are trying to unpack some of those ideas that were perpetuated for a long time. And I think that is happening now. There's really a nice, vibrant subculture of theology that talks a lot about art and how we have a lot of potential to engage with art more meaningfully and regularly. But I think it was kind of an unknown. So a lot of people were afraid of it. And I also think that sometimes artists' lives, which can be very complicated and maybe not always lining up with Christian values, were also something that kind of put people off a little bit. And so I think you kind of have this combined thing, a narrative where that wasn't really true, that we're unpacking now and discovering more about. You've got this idea that artists are really worldly and, you know, are trying to ruin culture, right, and things like that. And I think a combination of those things is what made people afraid to engage with modern art and abstract art.
I appreciate that. And one thing that you mentioned also in the midst of all that I hadn't considered before is that perhaps the way we've come to understand that period of time that you're talking about was shaped by the critics rather, yes, than by the artists themselves. That's a really interesting point I had not considered before. Yeah. Because yes, I think definitely when you're contemporary to something, it can oftentimes be more difficult. I think it's, yes, it's important for us to explore contemporary voices when we're exploring a period of time, but there can be blind spots, there can be overreactions and things like that. And mm-hmm. certainly, I think, as you said, there was concern about the personalities perhaps that were behind, yes, some of these works of art, but I had not considered who's shaping the way that we've come to understand that period. Was it really the, right, artist's message itself, or was it the way that the, right, art was received? And that's really interesting. So I appreciate you pointing,
yeah,
out.
Well, Charlene Spretnak, she wrote a handy little book that I used several times in my dissertation. And she wanted to kind of, and this started in the late 80s when people started going, wait, do we really understand what happened in the 50s and 60s, right, in modern art? And even going all the way back to Kandinsky and Mondrian and some of those who had very spiritual reasons for creating the abstract art that they did, you know, do we really understand those artists? And so that started in the late 80s with a really important art show. But then later Spretnak decides, she's like, I'm going to unpack this even more and I'm going to write a book. And she said that the topic was covered so infrequently in the contemporary lives of the artists that in order to mine it, she had to just flip through books page by page. There was no reference to this in any of the indices, nothing. She couldn't, wow, like, you know, efficiently cover this, right, topic because they hadn't addressed it in the contemporary age. And really a look back at this is finding that, you know, they have their own reasons for pushing what they thought art should be. Right. And it wasn't necessarily what the artists had to say, but artists aren't always their best advocates, you know, their best own, sure, advocates and things like that. And a lot of times they're not even great business people. That's not what they're in it for. And so their narrative kind of gets shoved aside. But even then, when you read what they actually wrote, they're here proclaiming certain things, but the narrative still didn't pick it up for
what. Yeah. As you're talking about that, I think about, it was a quote by Mark Rothko that he talks about, like, the person that weeps before his painting, yes, is someone who's having the same spiritual experience that he had while,
that's right,
while painting it. And so, yes, so yeah, for him, the activity was deeply religious at some level. And so,
yes,
yeah, yep, that's really good. So as you said, in your dissertation, went through different eras, mm-hmm, and talked about the abstraction in those eras. So two of particular interest to me are the classical and then the Protestant uses of abstraction. So let's start with the classical view. Typically, the classical view of art is kind of summarized as mimesis, this a kind of
imitation or
reproduction. Imitation, thank you. Mm-hmm. A kind of reproduction, yeah, a kind of imitation. Mm-hmm. And so where does abstraction work its way into, mm-hmm, classical art?
Mm. That's a good question too. I would say, however, if we're looking at classical art generally, when we want to say where we actually see abstraction, you're going to see a lot of abstraction in the very early Greek art, and you're going to see some abstraction in Hellenistic art. Yeah. But high classical art is very rational and very, you know,
right,
very mimetic. It's not, and it's idealized even. I wouldn't say that would be one of the periods of time where we would say abstraction was an important factor. But certainly if you look at archaic Greek art, that has all that Mesopotamian influence and even Egyptian influence and things like that. And you definitely see examples of abstraction. But what I found most interesting about studying the classical era in regards to mimesis and art was in the philosophy and how that philosophy has been utilized by later artists throughout time. And it kind of all goes back to the Republic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Everything, right? Does, right?
Yes, it all goes back. No Return of the Republic, right. Which, boy, I had to read about 400 times to feel like I really had a grip on it to write my dissertation. But the thing that's really interesting, I think, is that a lot of times we interpret Socrates' words to kind of justify a kind of art that is superior, and that is an art that is more naturalistic. But I argue in my dissertation that that's not necessarily the case. And I, if you don't mind, I'd like to unpack that just a little bit, because, you know, if we review this, we've got, you know, it's all about the couch. There's a God-produced couch that exists in a realm that we don't have access to, that we cannot see. And then there's the carpenter-produced couch and a painter-produced couch. And Socrates argues that the carpenter-produced couch is closer to the truth, and that he, because it is more in line with what the couch truly is. The painting, though, he says, it's not. It's third removed from truth, and that it's kind of too far removed to be useful. And so, or to be meaningful, I guess what you could say, as far as art is concerned. And historically, there have been a lot of people that have interpreted that to mean that the more realistic something is, the more integrity it has.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. But there have been a lot of scholars who have looked at this and said, let's back up a little bit, because that's not exactly what he's saying. In fact, Socrates says, therefore, with respect to beauty and badness, the imitator will neither know nor opine rightly about what he imitates. And so many scholars have suggested that what Socrates is doing here is just giving an example. He's not literally saying that the more photorealistic something, the better. He's saying the medium doesn't matter so much. What matters is the philosophy and integrity of the artist and how well they are familiar with the object, right?
That's really interesting. I've been doing some of this work for my own dissertation, so it's fresh on the mind.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that was brought to my attention in my reading is that what's interesting is that example he's ultimately using for getting rid of the poets. Yes. A lot of scholars believe that he's not actually getting rid of the visual artists along with the poets. Mm-hmm. So even though he's using an example from the visual arts, I think this furthers your point is, no, he's more concerned with the idea or the philosophy that's being communicated. Mm-hmm. Rather than, is it something we can see and you matched it perfectly? I think that would be, more consistent of an interpretation of what he's doing.
Well, and to go with that, of course, Plato is using a literary device to communicate his ideas in the first place. And so he himself is a poet.
Right.
So, you know, there's that whole dichotomy as well, yes. Where he's communicating in the very way that he's warning everybody about, right? So I think we can assume that he doesn't think he's being untrue.
Right.
And so ultimately with mimesis, the problem is more with overt sensuous appeal that is vapid ultimately, or not truthful, not that it necessarily, you know, is completely realistic. And I think that opens up a lot of possibilities in art, because what we want to do then is get to the truth of something. That's what's most important. And sometimes, as Aristotle pointed out, like he does with history, for instance, poetry is universal, history right. is specific or particular. And that, you know, he basically would say that sometimes if you're too realistic in tragedy, for instance, if you're so realistic that people are sensationalized by the gratuitous nature of it, they're going to think about that and not about the lessons that have to be taught. And so he was all for not being completely realistic. He was all for artistic convention, which made sure that the truth of the subject came out and not that it was completely realistic or true to life. And so Aristotle argues that in Poetics. And then later, I don't know if you're familiar at all with Xenophon's Memorabilia, but that has a few little nuggets that are really interesting, because Socrates takes a painter and a sculptor to task and he asks them all his hard questions about what they're doing and why. And ultimately he reminds them, you know, you may be very skilled, you know, but ultimately what you're really trying to do is communicate the spirit of your subject, the truth or the soul, the heart of your subject, not just what it looks like. And that can be seen in all sorts of art, even art that is realistic. You're going to have things that are exaggerated. Like for instance, right. Michelangelo's David has huge disproportionate hands, which has all sorts of symbolic meaning. And so of course, he's not saying he literally had hands this size. They're meant to tell the truth of David, not literally represent what he looked like. So, and of course, I'm sure David was not quite that idealized of a subject anyway, you know, right. The whole thing right. is a construct anyway. So that's when we're getting down to it is truth in art. And so I think when we're talking about mimesis, many people have interpreted it as meaning we got to be as realistic as possible and abstract art isn't justified by what Plato has to say. And I personally do not think that is true at all. I think if you have abstract art that is exploring concepts that, I mean, how do you depict infinity
right.
or eternity or grace? I mean, how do you literally depict some of those things? That gets very hard to do with these very conceptual ideas. And you can definitely, I think, explore those kinds of complex thoughts in art, and abstraction may be the best way to do that. So you're still dealing with truth. It's just through the language of abstraction instead of realism.
Excellent. That's really helpful. And I think it just fits so nicely with just even Plato's philosophy in general, right? I mean, the idea that Plato would be obsessed with artists depicting what we encounter with our senses perfectly seems odd in light of the fact that he's saying this is just a shadow of the true thing that is beyond us and in the world of forms. So he's far more concerned with what is transcendent and what is exactly. beyond this world of the senses. Mm-hmm. And so I think what you've proposed fits more neatly within yes. his broader philosophy. So that's yeah. really good.
And really so many modern artists. Now, there are abstractionists who do not consider themselves adherents to Platonic theory. There are some who sure. they say that's too disembodied. You know, I'm all about the incarnation, you know, and that's fine. We can have lots of different approaches, but Kandinsky, Mondrian, Mailovich, all those early abstractionists were very much Platonic in their thoughts and approaches. And then if you look, you know, at a lot of modern artists too, they are definitely trying to use art as a way to transcend. And we're consciously doing that through Platonic thought.
So the next kind of era that I was interested in discussing is the traditional Protestant interpretation of art as metaphor. Mm-hmm. And I'm particularly interested because I think while certainly, I think Christianity in general recently has been critical of modern art, it seems to me in my reading, some of the harshest criticisms have come from Protestants
yes.
in particular. And so I'm curious what you came up with in looking at more traditional Protestant interpretation of art. And also you described it as metaphor. So maybe mm-hmm. you can help us contrast that with mimesis that we just yeah. with the classical period.
Yeah, great. Yeah, my chapter 4 is mostly about kind of Protestant approaches to abstraction, and because it's different. It's definitely right. different than what we've been talking about. And I would almost go so far as to say that a lot of Protestant art argues almost dialectically through visual metaphor. And I think there's it definitely comes from the origins of Protestantism. So we have Luther and Zwingli and Calvin and others who are trying to distance themselves from the Catholic Church. And of course, the Catholic Church, with their analogical worldview, relied and largely illiterate populace during that time relied heavily on symbols and iconography. And although we can't always say their relationship with art has been smooth, right. I mean, they had to, you know, make proclamations through councils about the role of icons and things like that. But eventually things settled by about the year 800 into we're fully embracing art as an important part of our worship services. However, some have argued that the art in the Catholic Church became so ubiquitous that it became disenchanted. Even though it was supposed to be so sacred, by the time we get to the end of the era and towards Protestantism, it had lost some of its original meaning and depth in the perception of the viewers because it had just become so ubiquitous. It was just like wallpaper
right.
instead of being something special. special. So we see the early Protestants, Luther didn't really have a strong theology of the arts. He did come out and make a statement where he said, please quit destroying art. He did say that.
He did. Yeah.
And he did believe that art could be used to teach. And so I don't know if you're familiar with like Luther's Bible that he put together, his illustrated Bible and things like that. So he felt like art could be used in a didactic way, and that was fine. Now, Zwingli thought that art should not be made at all. He just thought that the Bible prohibited it and it should be gone. And Calvin had a really interesting approach where he's like, I really like art, but I don't want it associated with worship practices anymore. Again, I think in part of that distancing themselves from the Catholic tradition. And so if you, go to a Calvinist church today or those offshoots that are influenced by Calvinism, a lot of times you're going to look at a church building that has absolutely no decoration at all. And the emphasis is on the word and your interpretation of the word. And I think the lack of art kind of just suggests that they don't want an intermediary getting in the way between you and the word, right? So that pushed in Calvinist societies, and I'll specifically talk about the Dutch.
Sure.
In Calvinist societies, that pushed art out of its primary purpose, which was to be religious and to be in the churches. But then there are still artists, and what are they supposed to do, right? So art gets pushed to the secular. And Calvin was totally all for this. He said, yeah, we can have beautiful and lovely things in our lives. That's not a problem. However, the religious sensibilities of the people still imbued that secular art with a great amount of metaphor. And so then we start seeing the beautiful still life paintings. We see the Vanitas paintings, which are like little sermons where they're basically, giving you ideas about, don't focus on this life. That's all vanity. Focus on things that are important. So they're like these little tiny sermons encapsulated in art. And it does assume a literary audience. It assumes, which was a very important aspect of Protestantism, was that people needed to be literate so they could read the Bible. And they used lots of symbols. So bread and water is not really bread and water. It's the Eucharist, or bread and wine in many instances. An open walnut is the symbol of the tomb. All these different kinds of things. A white napkin could be the linen that draped Christ in the tomb. There are all these different symbols that can be unpacked that started to be used with such regularity that they became tropes, if you will. That isn't to say, though, that the art doesn't have meaning for other people. So if you take someone who doesn't have that background at all, you take someone and put them in the, last time I was in the Louvre, I spent all the time where nobody was, which was in all the Dutch artists, and it was great. You put someone there who doesn't have a Protestant background at all, and they're going to be riveted by how beautiful it is and the exquisite depictions, but they're not going to understand the metaphorical layer and the fact that this is pretty much an abstraction you're looking at.
Right.
At a piece of visual rhetoric that is explaining really eternal concepts to you, but through the visual medium, which is so interesting if we relate it to language, right? Because with the emphasis on language, we learn language through symbols and all that kind of thing. So it's all really quite interrelated and quite beautiful.
It's interesting as you're saying that, because I'm also seeing some parallels to some of the early church, right? So really early in Christianity for a number of reasons. We don't have a lot of early Christian art for several reasons. But I know that at least part of that is Second Commandment concerns, right? Yes. Making graven images, idolatry, those kinds of things. But what we do see when art starts to come around is the shepherd holding the lamb. Right. And so we see a similar approach where it's almost for, in a Christian context, it's almost inevitable that something has to come out through the art, some kind of religious meaning. And so metaphor seems safer, I guess, for those that
were. Well, and really, if you're considering that Christians were persecuted in the Roman Empire until Constantine, you've got these wonderful renditions of art where it could be Roman or it could be Christian,
Right.
So just depending on the context. And a lot of times we're not totally sure, we're like Christian, Roman, And so that's an interesting
idea. Yeah. Okay, great. And so you shared with me some of the chapter summaries and things like that. And so your thesis states that abstraction can be a profoundly viable way to communicate as well as facilitate spiritual and religious experiences for both artists and viewers, which should be particularly significant to Christians. And so I feel like we're getting there. You know, and I'm just noticing this as we're talking, even at times where it was, no, religion and art shouldn't mix, or we need to kind of keep these things separate. People were still almost inevitably expressing something of a religious nature. And so I'm curious, how is it that you think abstraction can help communicate and facilitate these religious experiences in art?
Well, there's so many ways, really. And if I could just back up and say something kind of assertively, I wouldn't say that it just could help. I would say historically it has facilitated. Okay. And the reason for that is because the dominant style of art around the world has an abstract quality to it. Realism that was, and like a heightened naturalism that was defined by the Renaissance and was so popular in the West until the Impressionists, basically, that is a very small portion of the world's produced art. And I'm not degrading that art at all. I love that art. It's some of my favorite stuff ever. However, there's been that consistent narrative that really comes from the Renaissance that abstraction is somehow lesser than realistic depictions. And I think that's something that we could just get rid of and acknowledge that art comes in all shapes and forms and expressions and styles and be okay with that. So, you know, and what we also see, which is so interesting, is that, and I don't want to oversimplify things, but I guess for the sake of, you know, a short interview, I will a little bit.
Sure.
And that is, we have, you know, patterns, I guess you could say, of human thought that occur over and over again. And when we, it's like the Apollonian versus the Dionysian balance, I guess you could say, in some ways. But a lot of times, abstraction in art has been an antidote for a society that has become too rational. And this actually happens several times. But at the same time, rationality in art also is an antidote to art that has become too mystical.
Interesting.
So it's kind of this thing where you've got this pattern back and forth that's happened several times, right? So, you know, you have, you know, Middle Ages art, medieval art that contrasts so much with Renaissance art, for instance. I mean, that's such a difference. But then you have, like, I was so moved when I read about Kandinsky. Of course, he wrote that important book concerning the spiritual in art. And Russian society, when he was growing up, was extremely utilitarian. It was positivistic. It was completely disenchanted. Religion had become more of something you do as a social contract, not really done with any kind of meaning. And he felt like the world had lost its soul, essentially. So his whole goal in tapping into the spiritual side of himself and to create this art and then to create these very open-ended, and a lot of people don't realize that Kandinsky, a lot of his work that's semi-abstract has all sorts of religious themes to it, like in the titling and everything. That was something really common because he's very influenced by Russian Orthodox religion. And then he actually combined that with theosophy and spirituality in his own life later. But he just felt like the world was in trouble, that they had lost the sense of things that were really, really important, that feelings and emotions and our effective way of learning had been pushed aside for utilitarian pragmatism. And so I think we often see that abstraction is in response to that. And even the abstract expressionists, there was a lot of nihilist thought after World War II, right? And the art of the interwar years, especially in Germany and the United States, heavily realistic. We've got like Grant Wood and the regional art painters. We've got all of Hitler's ordained art. We've got socialist realism. And they were saying, I want none of that. That all has political connotations that I don't agree with. The government's controlling it. If I retreat into abstraction, maybe I can touch on something that we've been missing for a long time. And so I think if we can understand better the origins and goals of abstraction and the role that it's played in art, we can start to have a sense a little bit more of how it could be important. I don't think this is possible without aesthetic education. You know, I think we're going to have to be better in our Christian communities to educate people about being excellent consumers and partakers of art. We need to be better about that. We need to teach a little bit more. You know, one thing that has always stuck with me and is when I started with Faulkner, and I had to watch Dr. Wood's intro. He reminded us that as researchers, we needed to always exercise charity. And I tell that to my art students all the time. I say, you know, don't just look at something and dismiss it. Assume there's something important there. Assume that the artist has something important that he or she is trying to impart to you.
That's right.
And assume the best of them. And, you know, I do understand the concern with artists who sometimes live lives that are atypical or threatening to Christians. But at the same time, we have to exercise charity there. We're all imperfect. We all require grace. So, you know, we need to be sensitive to artists and their special needs too.
You're touching on something that I think is really important, because I think we have not developed a robust understanding of common grace in the world of art, right?
Yeah.
We do it in other things. We're more open to it in other areas.
Right.
For some reason in the art world, we've still not thought about these are image bearers that are making art. And so in that, I should expect to find some true things that are being communicated. And what I think is really... You go ahead.
But true things from imperfect people.
Yes. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I think it's interesting. And this has always been, because I'm still working through my own, you know, from my philosophy, what do we make of abstraction? Which was a major reason why I was looking forward to this conversation. And I've really enjoyed it. But what I do find interesting, and which is what I try to resist, is I think because people look at some abstract art and it seems weird, it seems strange.
Right.
They more easily, you know, dismiss it.
Yes.
Where I want to say, if, you know, setting abstraction aside, look at Gustave Courbet's work, look at his philosophy of art. It seems to me a Christian should be equally concerned, if you're going to take concern with kind of the philosophy that's being communicated, in the naturalism of some of those realist artists. The idea of, you know, I'm not, you know, show me an angel and I'll paint you one. Like, if all reality is what we can experience through our senses, right? Right? Like, exactly. It seems to me Christian communities should be concerned about that. But if they walked into, you know, a gallery that has all of the realist paintings that embrace that philosophy, they're far less likely to be skeptical of it than abstraction. Right. And so I think you're right. I think it's a superficial understanding that is causing us to reject it prematurely.
Well, and realism is not without its possible pitfalls. Right. I mean, it can become, realism can become kitschy, you know, realism can also become pornographic,
right.
You know, so really we have to be really careful about just saying, well, naturalism or, you know, realism is the apex of artistic achievement, because it's not without, I mean, in the hands of less skilled artists, it can be absolutely terrible, not good art at all. And that's also to say there's definitely quality in abstraction renditions as well, right? And you might even find that if you're exploring abstract art, that some artists are going to resonate more meaningfully with you than other ways, and it might be a little bit harder to explain why, but there are still things that would make it a more meaningful rendition than something else. So, you know, there's quality in that too, but we're not ever going to get there if we don't have some kind of aesthetic education in our Christian communities. And there's no reason not to, because our aesthetic sensibilities and our spiritual sensibilities are so intertwined that there's not really harm. Now, and I suppose in that way, I'm taking a little bit more of an analogical worldview, because some Protestant writers and art critics will say there's no such thing as spiritual aesthetics. Aesthetics are over here and spirituality is over here. But I don't personally bifurcate it. You know, I see them very much entwined. And I would say the times when I have been very moved by a piece of art or by a piece of theater or by a piece of music, it's because it has testified to my heart as something that is true.
I actually think, and I agree with you 100%, and I think that the distinction that's being made, or the separation that's being made, is really a strange one. Mm-hmm. If we think about the idea of anthropology, right? Even a theological anthropology.
Absolutely.
As far back as we go, and this is where I start my humanities classes, far back as we go, we've got art with us, which should cause us to think, is there something of a connection of what it means to be human what we're doing in art? Like, is there some kind of connection there? And if there is, and we would also say, I realize realize not everybody would agree, but we would also say that part of our anthropology is to be religious in some sense, right? In some broad sense, then art seems to be part of our nature and religion seems to be part of our nature. We should expect a lot of overlap in those things, it seems.
Yeah. Now, so, one thing I should just say really quickly is just why specifically abstraction, and we didn't get too much into this, maybe another time, but as far as having personal experiences with art, the phenomenal access aspect, or you could say phenomenology, is an important aspect because abstraction in art does encourage a more involved response from a viewer, but it also takes more effort. And it also means it's easier to dismiss because it takes effort, because hard things, we don't want to do hard things. We like easy things. And a lot of times in our Christian traditions, we're used to easy art that spells out a narrative. It has everything there. We don't have to think about it at all. And then when we're confronted with something that's a little more challenging, we're just like, it's not art. I mean, that's just what our human nature tends to be. But I wanted to just read a quote by the abstract artist Makoto Fujimura. I don't know if you're familiar with him at all, but he makes, and he's not alone in this, many modern abstract artists who are Christian or who are religious say similar things. And this is what he says: "I see abstraction as a potential language to speak to today's world about the hope of things to come. And for the follower of Christ who is making art to the glory of God, isn't this potential exciting? I believe that in many ways, spiritual qualities and ideas can be more readily accessible in abstraction than they would be in representational art, where renderings of familiar things often carry with them conceptual baggage. This baggage can mislead or even prohibit the viewer from moving further up and further into the spiritual to which the artwork points." That's so excellent. There's something to be said about abandoning the things we see every day.
That is really, really interesting. And I think it helps us kind of close well here, because my closing question to you, I think you've just answered it, was what do you say to those that are concerned that would say, you mentioned earlier, especially Nancy Piercy has criticized modern abstract art as nihilistic. Mm-hmm. And even if we don't want to go that far, certainly there's a lot of abstract art that communicates brokenness. Absolutely. And so, which I think Schaefer at least acknowledges is part of reality, right? There's a brokenness. And he makes the distinction. I don't remember his exact terminology right now, but he talks about like the smaller story and the grander story. And so within the smaller story, there's brokenness, right? Yeah. And so, but what about those who are concerned in saying, but what about the grander story? What about redemption? What about grace? And it seems like the quote you've just read responds to that yes, that's that can be found in abstraction as
absolutely. And you know, as far as I would really recommend the work of David Seidel. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he wrote a couple books that are really good.
It's Who's Afraid of Modern Art,
and the other one is God in the Gallery.
Yes.
And both of them make some really compelling arguments. You know, I'm not one to, you know, certainly I don't, as Christians, we don't want to involve ourselves with gratuity for the sake of gratuity. Certainly not. However, we do have to have truth in art. And if we're going to have truth, that means that it does have to address the brokenness, like you were saying, because if we deny our brokenness, then by association, we deny the saving grace that we need. Right. So it's a really important balance. And so Seidel, he says some great stuff. He's like, you know, we Christians, we're really great at being on a watchtower and going, that's bad, that's bad, that's bad, without really understanding. And another article I used in my dissertation by Travis Anderson from Brigham Young University in Utah, he gives this great metaphor where he's like, you know, when you're learning to ride a motorcycle, you're told, do not look where you don't want to go.
Right.
Because you'll end up where you don't want to go. Yeah. And so he says, instead, look where you want to go. And he ties that to art and finding the good in art, because if we look where we want to go, that's where we're going to see. I mean, if you look at a Rothko and you just say, oh, that's so nihilist, then that's what you're going to get out of it. But if you do a slow look, like Fujimura suggests, that sometimes takes 10, 12, 15 minutes before you can even get fully invested and open yourself up to the possibility opportunities, you might find that you have a really, really great experience because you're looking for something edifying. So I think a lot of times it just is our worldview. We're just really afraid sometimes. And we kind of want to buckle down and create walls. And Fujimura, which this book, Cultural Care, which I would also really recommend, he's like, we can't afford to do that. We need to interact with culture meaningfully, and not culture from 500 years ago. We need to do it with culture now. And not only that, we have to make our Christian communities open to the artists who blossom within our ranks. And if we just make them feel bad for, you know, what they want to explore artistically without understanding, and it's so true that artistic works, even when they're engaging with religious topics, are so often misunderstood because maybe it's critiquing, maybe it's pushing, maybe it's rubbing you wrong, but still asking really important questions. And so I think just exercising a little charity, not being quite so afraid, and knowing that culture is super important would be a great way to start.
Excellent. I would only add one additional thing to what you're saying, because I agree completely. I also think that also realizing, in order for Christian communities to allow for more of this, and Christianity does have a rich tradition from which to pull from. Yes. That says Christian communities can produce beautiful art that can affect culture. But then you also have to have the willingness to allow space for exploration, which means some of the works of art may genuinely be problematic, right?
That's like that. True.
Yes. So, but we have to give some space for that. Otherwise, the rest of it.
Right. And the space within an artist's own life.
Right.
To maybe make some mistakes with their art, or not be as genuine and be off track for a little while and then figure that out later. When I was in England, 2019, summer of 2019, and I did a cathedral. So I was trying to hit all the major cathedrals because I teach these in my art classes. And it was so cool what I saw there. And I'm hoping that we can see more of this, but several of the cathedrals had summer art shows going. That's and so within the cathedral itself, they would say they would have pieces. A lot of times they'll have like a modernly constructed baptismal font, you know, that is in contrast to the medieval background. In their cloisters, they had art shows set up everywhere with people vote on your favorite piece, say why you liked it, you know, that kind of thing. It gave me encouragement to see, because we do want to be a people that, at least in my opinion, that we acknowledge that art is a gift from God, and the people who create art are working on their unique gifts that have been given to them from God.
That's a perfect way for us to bring this conversation to a close. I just want to thank you again. I really appreciate you taking the time. I've really enjoyed the conversation, and I think it'll
really
be really great for our listeners.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Signature of Man podcast. Please be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already, leave a review, and share it out on social media. You can also email any comments or questions to thesignatureofman@gmail.com.